recess meeting is now called back into order. We have a just a slight change in the lineup, as it would be, before Midwest Gen, and then before the supporters, and then the general public. Ms. Faith, identify yourself for the record, please, and your position.
Hello, my name is Faith Bugel. I am a senior attorney with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. I am here representing the Clean Power Coalition today.
And you have a statement, Ms. Bugel?
I do, thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I mispronounced.
Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit about what this ordinance does and doesn't do. First, this is not a shutdown ordinance. The ordinance is not intended to get rid of all the jobs for the employees of Midwest Generation. On that point, what I would like to point out is that I understand that many of the people sitting here today in blue shirts were actually bused in from Northern Illinois and are not, in fact, employees at Fisk and Crawford. So I would ask that the City Council not be misled to think that every person in blue shirt sitting here today is an employee of Fisk and Crawford who might lose their job. But this is not a shutdown ordinance. It's not intended to cause people to lose jobs. In fact, it sets limits. And as you've already heard today, those limits can be met. One alternative to meeting those limits is repowering with natural gas. What I would like to point out is that if Midwest Gen chooses to comply with this ordinance by shutting down, it is the company making that choice, not City Council. With every environmental regulation, the coal companies have always cried wolf and said that it would cause them to shut down. An example of this is the Knox-SIP call. A dozen or so years ago when that was passed, there was a huge outcry from industry saying that it was going to shut down every coal plant in the nation. And in fact, that was not what happened. And the industry was able to comply with the limits without shutting down.
Danny.
Midwest Gen has the option of spending part of their voluminous profits for the pollution controls to meet the requirements of this ordinance. And if they did that, they would operate safely and responsibly. Alternatively, they can take that money and invest in renewable energy, energy efficiency, site redevelopment, and worker retraining. There is an example of that from South California Edison has successfully begun to phase out existing coal plants and invest in solar, wind, and efficiency as an alternative. And that would protect jobs. This is not a proxy for shutdown. Repowering with natural gas does not mean that the company would have to shut down because it's prohibitively expensive. There is a long list of plants from around the country, coal plants that have converted to natural gas and have done so at a reasonable cost that allows them to reduce their emissions but still provide electricity. Conversion to natural gas depends on numerous factors. One of those factors is the cost of natural gas, and other factors are weighed in, such as depreciation of capital. It is tough to predict how much it would cost. Natural gas prices go up or down. Nonetheless, we can tell you how much the cost has been of the particulate matter pollution from these plants, and that cost has been $127 million per year in ill health effects. It is time for the company to bear that cost and not the city or the residents of the communities in this city. You probably will hear later today arguments that these plants have already made huge pollution reductions and that they are already meeting standards. That is not true. These plants are only meeting the most minimal standards. They have not made any reductions besides ones that are required. And in fact, they have self-reported hundreds of violations of state and federal standards. The violations I'm talking about are opacity violations. They are subject to a federal enforcement action over those violations. They have not installed any modern pollution controls. They do not have fabric filters per 4 p.m. They do not have scrubbers for SO2. They do not have selective catalytic reduction for NOx. That is the lineup of modern pollution controls, and these plants don't have any of those. They have only outdated control technology. You may ask, if there's a federal enforcement action, why should the city do something? That is because roadblocks have been thrown up in that enforcement action. They are using every procedural device in the book to slow it down, and the city can respond, be nimble and quick, and respond to the health concerns instead of waiting for the federal action to resolve. In turn, you've heard a lot today about the MOU. You have heard a lot today about how that is a global settlement and should cover everything. In fact, it does not. That MOU was in response to two federal regulations, the Clean Air Interstate Rule and the Clean Air Mercury Rule. And it was written to address just the pollutants covered by those two regulations, mercury, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxide. It was not intended to resolve Midwest Generation's liability for any and every pollutant ad infinitum. It was narrowly focused on three pollutants. The pollutants that fell through the gap were particulate matter and carbon dioxide. And those are the pollutants that are subject to the ordinance. The MOU covers one set of pollutants, the ordinance covers another. There is no overlap. That does not mean that the MOU rules all. So you may hear arguments about whether or not the city needs this power. You've already received a lot of data on that. The city's distributor is Commonwealth Edison. Commonwealth Edison does not contract with Midwest Gen for any of the power from Fisk and Crawford. That power is sold into the regional market called PJM. It's a large market that goes from the Midwest all the way to New Jersey. And then on that market, ComEd buys back power that it needs during peak times. It is a huge market. So the fact is, Midwest Gen is owned by a California company, Edison International. The profits that Midwest Gen makes leave the state to go to Edison International. So Wyoming, the coal that Midwest Gen burns is from Wyoming. So Wyoming is getting the profits from selling its coal. The parent company in California gets the profits from selling the electricity. The Midwest regional market gets the electricity, not Chicago. Chicago gets one thing. Chicago gets the pollution. So, another point that's come up today is electric grid reliability or stability. I actually have brought with me the petition and testimony and the ultimate order from the Illinois Commerce Commission. ComEd went to the Commerce Commission and asked for rate recovery for transmission upgrades. ComEd recently installed the 345 kilovolt Burnham-Taylor line. ComEd indicated that when it installed that line, it created enough stability and reliability in transmission such that one of the plants could shut down without any threats to reliability or stability. In other words, blackouts. ComEd was asking for rate recovery for a second 345 kilovolt line. That was approved by the Commerce Commission. ComEd, in its testimony, explicitly said that the installation of this line would mean that both Fisk and Crawford could shut down without any threats to reliability or stability. And I have that testimony, should anyone be interested in seeing it. You may also hear that the state and federal government are the proper authorities to regulate CO2 and PM. And the fact is, the city is the last hope. We have waited many, many years. The residents of Pilsen and Little Village and this city as a whole have lived with the pollution from these plants for 50 years. We have waited for federal action. Federal action has stalled. We have hoped for state action. State action delivered a statewide agreement that did not cover PM or CO2 and that put Fisk and Crawford last, dead last, in a 10-year or more than a 14-year plan for retrofits and upgrades. That plan requires flue gas desulfurization at Fisk and Crawford in 2015 and 2018. Instead of installing a scrubber, which is the best, most effective technology for sulfur reductions, Midwest Gen is now trying again to find a loophole. And that loophole is dry sorbent injection, which will cause worse particulate matter. And they are trying to do that instead of installing a scrubber that they committed to. So we cannot count on the state MOU and the state regulations to reduce pollution, PM pollution, from these plants in 2015 and 2018. In fact, PM pollution that rains down on the residents of the city of Chicago may get worse at that time. And that is why we are turning to the city. I would like to address a little bit about your authority to do this, because I've actually spent years researching this. First, the city of Chicago has the constitutionally given right to protect the health of city residents. That power cannot easily be taken away. It has to be taken away with an express statement in legislation stating that the legislature is intending to preempt home rule on the topic covered. The legislature has not done that on the matter of setting limits on air pollution. I am wondering if this city council would actually sit by while the plants harm the health of city residents and say leave it to the state when the state has done nothing. I would hope that this city council would not allow its home rule authority to be stolen away without an express statement by the Illinois legislature. Just to touch on a couple cases, you have already heard about the Sexton case today. There's a lot of to-do around that case. But first, that case is 30 years old. Second, there was one single extraneous paragraph that talked about uniform standards with environmental regulations, but that paragraph is actually not binding because the court did not rely on that paragraph in making its ultimate decision. In fact, the court went on to uphold the ordinance at issue in that case, which was an environmental ordinance. And the court said, I quote, "It was upholding the ordinance in spite of the uniformity goal of the State Environmental Protection Act." Over the past 25 years, the court has not elaborated at all on the Sexton's muddled so-called requirement. But what's important to note is that the Illinois Supreme Court has not struck down any local environmental ordinance enacted by a home rule unit on the grounds laid out by Sexton. That paragraph has never been applied to strike down an environmental ordinance or preempt home rule. In fact, the Supreme Court has stated in the Pesticide Public Policy Foundation versus Wakanda, whether the legislature has sought uniformity of regulation is a question entirely separate from whether the legislature has used the proper method of preempting home rule. So it took the Sexton paragraph and said that that wasn't about preempting home rule. And in fact, the Supreme Court has been consistent in stating that the test is whether or not there's an express statement in legislation.
We're supportive of this, that it doesn't appear raised any concern or alarm about alarming pollutants.
There's actually a very specific reason for that, and this was because there were two federal rules.
I understand.
And they were the clean air mercury rule and the clean air interstate rule. And the state regs were not being written voluntarily. They were actually being written to implement two federal rules. And those federal rules simply covered, the clean air mercury rule covered mercury, and the clean air interstate rule covered sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. So no one was volunteering to go further than that. And really the objective was to put in place rules that would comply and implement federal rules. And that's the reason.
I understood the impetus, the catalyst for that, but I just think in my heart that if I were an environmentalist and I knew that there was something else, and I'm not just saying you, I'm saying our department, state, whomever was involved, I would say, you know, this is fine, but let's put a caveat on it saying we have to continue to work in this MOU or any of the state or federal laws have to be expanded to take care of this. That didn't happen at any level at all. It just dealt with that. And I fully understand, but I have to ask each of the parties why that didn't occur. Mm-hmm. So that's all. Questions? Thank you very much. Oh, I'm so sorry, Alderman Solis. I didn't see
you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, the question you just asked was a question I was going to ask, and mine is more personal. It's because after we had, Alderman Burke and I had co-sponsored the 2002 ordinance, we were invited to the press conference, and it was at Alivio, I believe, that we had the press conference to basically applaud this memorandum of understanding, this agreement. And so that was in 2006. And I wish, you know, that we had been alerted. And when I say we, not just myself, but Alderman Burke, that it wasn't complete, it wasn't sufficient. But nevertheless, I'm going to echo my colleagues' points that they made about you, that this is a very, not only passionate, but very compelling argument that you've just made that has given me more information to help deal with this issue, as I intend to do, to get it to its fruition. Now, my big question is, if these transitions have been done, again, I asked the Commissioner of Environment, in these other states, and I think this gentleman, I forget your last name. Nillis made it in the press conference earlier. You know the cost of these other states. You know the timeline in these other states. You know the impact or the repercussions on the various interest groups when these transitions were made. Can you give me some information, some illumination? Can you give this committee some illumination as to examples of the transition from coal power to natural gas or just from cleaning up these power plants? I think it's important to know that this can happen and how it happened and what it took.
I'd be happy to.
We had only, they had said they only wanted one person, but if you can be brief, Alderman Moore had said that his witnesses were going to be 3 to 5 minutes.
Sure, I'd be happy.
And Midwest Gen said they were going to have people that were very brief as well.
I think this is a very important question.
That's a question, and you can answer and also provide to the committees, any data that you have as well.
I'd be happy to.
And identify yourself and your position.
Thank you very much. My name is Bruce Nillis, and I work for the Sierra Club. There was a lot of discussion in the last couple hours about what were the opportunities and how have other communities dealt with this. And Chicago is far from the first cities and communities around the country dealing with this issue. In fact, Chicago is one of the last cities in the country with coal-fired power plants in the middle of densely packed residential areas. And it's starting to stand markedly from other communities, not just here in the Midwest, but around the country. Let me give you a couple of examples. 4 years ago, Minneapolis had 3 coal-fired power plants. Those will all be done burning coal in the next 1 year. So they've been phasing out the 3 coal plants in the Twin Cities. Why? Because they identified that the pollution from coal-fired power plants was such a huge threat to the public health, and the fact that the public taxpayer was paying for these health costs was unacceptable, and we need to do something about those coal plants in Minneapolis.
Are you saying they were closed or that they were shut down? Is it closed or retrofitted?
Two of them were replaced with natural gas and one installed modern pollution controls. Denver, Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, we just reached an agreement with the governor, the owner of those coal plants, and the local unions to replace the two coal plants in the middle of those urban areas as well, one replaced with gas and one being phased out and being replaced with wind and solar in the years ahead. Madison, Wisconsin, my hometown, 2 years ago had 3 coal plants. At the end of this year, they stopped burning coal, all 3 of them. One was owned by the university, one owned by the state, and one owned by Madison Gas and Electric. And similarly there, the decision was, these are cities just like Chicago, aspires to have a green leadership and protect its residents from some of the worst issues not being addressed by the federal government, and coal plants are at the top of that list. So those are 3 examples across the country. An even bigger example, the Tennessee Valley Authority owns and operates 59 coal boilers. Last week announced it was retiring 18 of those, and the rest of them are going to get installed with modern pollution controls. This is in those really progressive places like Alabama, Kentucky, Tennessee. They're not allowing these coal plants to continue to operate without modern pollution controls in those states. We can do better, and that's why what is before you needs action and needs action urgently. President Obama and Lisa Jackson of the EPA are prosecuting this company because it is violating long-established Clean Air Act standards and trying to force that company to put on modern pollution controls. With the high-priced lawyers, they are pulling out every legal trick in the book, and so far, as many of these companies do around the country, are delaying and delaying and delaying judgment day, because that keeps the profits rolling in. It's not because we don't agree they aren't violating. They've been issued a notice of violation. They are required to report that they're violating the law today. All that's happening is that the wheels of justice are turning way too slowly because of their high-priced lawyers using all the gimmicks in the book. And that's why it's so very, very important that the city not stand by and say, this is okay, because it's your constituents who are paying the price. It is a California company that's reaping in the profits. Something is deathly wrong with this image, and I urge you to act sooner rather than later.
Thank you. Is this Sierra Club's involvement, is this part of a nationwide effort?
It is.
And is it Sierra Club joined with other organizations to, I'm not going to say close down, to make coal-fired plants either change or close down? Is that an overall objective?
Today in Washington State, the state Senate is putting the final touches and a final vote to shut down that state's one coal plant. That is something we've been working on for the last 2 years.
I see.
It's an effort that's going on from the state of Washington to the state of Florida because of the inaction in Washington. And key piece that's also just really quickly, the reason we don't have any national legislation on climate change and the reason that Lisa Jackson is being called up to the Capitol every day and beaten up by the Republicans because she has the audacity to stand up for clean air is because the coal industry is pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into our political system. That's what's standing between science and good public policy. That's what's standing between action in Washington and the fact that we're having these serious problems. So yes, we have a national campaign to take the money of the coal industry out of politics, and yes, we have a national campaign to clean up the air, because we've known about scrubbers for 30 years. This is not some newfangled technology. But why is it there's a coal plant in the most dense urban area in the country on the south side of Chicago that hasn't installed modern pollution controls? That's what's insane.
I think there is a whole other agenda. 99, with the Clinton administration, they began the rather aggressive, and then we've had many years of opposition to any of that aggressive, and so there's a huge political aspect to the slowly moving wheels that I think frustrate all of us as well, but it looks as though we're going to have some aggression again, so you're obviously trying to tap into that that movement to get everything going again.
And so thanks, Chicago. I mean, you've been a leader on so many things, and this is really a big unfinished piece of business. I mean, this is, when you look across the landscape of all the stuff you've done on building codes and green, this and that, it is remarkable. But there's this one big blemish, which is these two very old coal plants.
No, they have. Well, I'll ask them. Never mind. They have cleaned up their other ones, so never mind. We'll ask Midwest Gen. One more question?
Through the chair, this was a summary, and I understand the agreement that was made about the time. But I would like, through this chair, if you could get some information, more detailed information, in terms of what you just reported, especially in terms of other implications, like in terms of jobs that were created and what's going on now. That's, as I said in my earlier statement, it's important to me for us to understand that this is not you do one thing, you kill jobs. You know, if you keep this, you get contamination. I think it's important that you give that information out.
I'd be happy to. I mean,
and of those that were closed, no, of those that you spoke about, the numbers that were retrofitted, if you have any idea of cost, I guess that's just information that would be nice to know, as well as those that were then shut, so we can look at the, you know, what's happening around the entire country. Alderman Balser?
I would just say the agreement we have in Washington State to shut down that 1970 coal plant, so it's only 40 years old, unlike the 1907 coal plants on the south side of Chicago. The one in Washington State has scrubbers, but they're still agreeing to shut it down. We're standing side by side with our brothers and sisters at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in agreeing on the legislation that's retiring and phasing out that coal plant. So there are ways to do this, and that's the opportunity I think we have before us.
Alderman Balser.
Just a quick question. Are you holding ComEd responsible at all? ComEd had it for how many years? How many, 1903 to 1999? Are their feet being held to the fire?
Well, their feet were being held to the fire in the litigation.
Where are they now? I'm just questioning this. Yeah. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Just for the record, they've been dismissed from the lawsuit.
I'm not finished.
I'm happy to testify on the hearing if you want to have a hearing.
You've said enough. Let me say something. Why shouldn't they be forced to pay money? Why shouldn't they be forced to come before us and own up to what they've done? I mean, these guys are trying to do something. And don't get me wrong, I'm not taking their side. You and I talked. We've had our long talk about where I live. But where's ComEd? Why aren't their feet being held to the fire here? Why aren't they being held accountable with all of this? That's all. I said enough.
There are no further questions. Thank you very much. We have Midwest Gen executives who would like to speak, and they told me that their testimony would take 20 minutes total for all of them. Without questions. Doug McFarland, the president, I believe, is going to introduce, and I don't think everyone on this list is going to be testifying, but we will learn. Good afternoon. Identify yourself first and then introduce those that, after you speak or whomever will be speaking.
Chairman Balser, committee members, my name is Doug McFarland. I'm the president of Midwest Generation with offices here in Chicago. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you about the serious public policy and jobs implications of the so-called Clean Power Ordinance. I joined Midwest Generation in 1999 when our parent company, Edison Mission Group of Santa Ana, California, acquired 6 coal-fired power plants in Illinois, including the Fisk and Crawford stations here in Chicago. Prior to that, I had served in a variety of policy and regulatory positions with Chicago telecommunications company, Ameritech, that's now part of AT&T. I also serve as a senior vice president of Edison Mission Group, the parent company, and I'm pleased to be joined today by our president of Edison Mission Group, to my left, Pedro Pizarro, who you'll be hearing from shortly. Also with me today, immediately to my right, are Dean Apple, the president of Local 15 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and at my far left is Brenda Brock, station director at the Fisk and Crawford plants here in Chicago. And we're also joined to Pedro's left by Dr. Peter Valberg, a principal at Gradient, an environmental and risk science consulting firm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, And I think Dr. Valberg will be able to shed a lot of light and answer a lot of questions that have been raised about health impacts and fine particulates, et cetera. Our management and labor team is here today to express our strong opposition to this ordinance. The issues it raises are being addressed by the U.S. and Illinois Environmental Protection Agencies and through work that has been ongoing at Fisk and Crawford for several years. Because of that activity, the only real-world impact of this ordinance would not be environmental, it would be economic, risking 200 jobs at the stations, hundreds of thousands of hours of building and trades work, and the reliability and stability of the electric grid serving the city of Chicago. I'm going to devote my remarks to addressing several myths and just flat-out false statements that we've heard from supporters of this ordinance over the past year. Also try to address some of the things that have come up in the last couple of hours here today. First of all, on February 22, happened to be primary election day, we were literally stunned to see a front page headline in the Chicago Tribune that said, coal plant cleanups may have to wait. And the online version of that story had a headline that said, power company holds off on cleaning up Chicago plants. Let me be clear, those statements are false. We have not delayed any work. We have not asked to delay any work. We have literally led the nation by installing mercury emission controls at the Fisk and Crawford stations in 2008 using a technology that we helped develop with the U.S. Department of Energy. The mercury reductions were achieved under the comprehensive 2006 agreement we reached with the Illinois EPA that's been discussed at length here today. And that agreement laid out a blueprint for construction of additional pollution controls beyond mercury at all of our Illinois plants over a 10-year period of continuous work. As part of that plan, no sooner was the mercury work completed than we were well into designing controls to further reduce emissions of nitrogen oxide. Construction work on those projects is ongoing as we speak here in the city and will be completed by the end of this year. This new round of work is on top of 60% reduction in these emissions that we achieved within the first 3 years of owning the plants back in 2000-2001. And reductions in nitrogen oxide do result also in reductions of PM2.5, the fine particulates that you've been talking about so much. Now, while that work is in progress on nitrogen oxide, we are also well into the design and engineering work to further reduce emissions of particulate matter and sulfur dioxide. By 2015, as you've heard, we must either complete the installation of sulfur dioxide controls at Fisk or shut down the unit. We have similar requirements on our two units at the Crawford Station in 2017 and 2018. And again, when we reduce emissions of sulfur dioxide, we also are reducing fine particulate emissions, the PM2.5. Another word based on something that we've heard recently. We intend to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions with the installation of what's called dry sorbent injection systems, and you were just told that that's inadequate. I'm here to tell you that we have rates, emission rates, given to us by the Illinois EPA that are based on protecting the environment and public health, and the message to us from the regulators both in Washington and in Springfield has been, we will set emission rates based on protecting environment, public health. You figure out how to meet them in the most cost-effective manner. That's what we're doing. We will hit rates that we're required to hit by the regulators using the dry sorbent injection system that was described. It was also said that that will increase our particulate emissions. Not true. We've already permitted a couple of projects for the dry sorbent injection system, and accompanying those are upgrades to our particulate removals. So we do that hand in hand. So there is no increase in particulate emissions when we do that. None of this is delay. It's ongoing work, and it's ongoing for a decade. It is not unusual for projects of this magnitude to take 3 to 4 years from inception to completion. They have to be designed, tested, permitted. We have to procure supplies. We have to contract for labor. We have to build. These are massive undertakings. We're doing the work across 6 plants in this state, plants which also must keep running in order to generate the revenue that pays for the improvements. And by the way, they also have generated revenue that we use to build one of the largest clean energy wind farms in the state of Illinois. What we have said repeatedly for more than 2 years is that because of new regulations that are coming from Washington and the US EPA and uncertainty about how all of those are going to end up, it is prudent and responsible for our business to let as many pieces fall into place as possible before you make final technology and investment decisions. So we made those decisions when they were required for mercury and nitrogen oxide controls. Next, we come up on the decision points for sulfur dioxide. We will continue to design and engineer those projects, and when we get to the point where we have to make the decision on the major capital investments for construction and labor, we'll have to decide whether to proceed with that work or retire the units. But again, those decisions will be made within the time frames established by federal and state regulators. There are no delays. If we end up making retrofits at all of our plants in this state from the start of the mercury controls in 2008 through 2018, we will wind up spending about $1.5 billion. We don't do that lightly. I've heard proponents of this ordinance say repeatedly they don't want to shut down the plants, just clean them up. First of all, they are being cleaned up. But secondly, let's listen to these folks in their own words, the supporters of the ordinance, quoting a Sierra Club executive, closing these two coal plants is a national priority for the club. A news story from Medill News, headline, protesters rally to shut down Chicago's coal plants. A quote from one of the protesters, this is the year we're going to end coal in Chicago. The director of the Natural Resources Defense Council office here in Chicago, Mayor Emanuel, will have the opportunity to lead the city forward by assuring that the necessary work has been done to allow Fisk and Crawford to be closed. A field organizer from Greenpeace quoted, the mayor's green legacy depends on whether he closes these plants. Again, from Sierra Club, we are gearing up, as Mr. Nillis just said, we are gearing up to run a 30-state program to shutter coal plants. Regionally, we need to pull coal out of the energy mix. Story in the Chicago Reader, national advocates say Chicago could be a role model to show other cities how they can take the initiative in shutting down plants. Ordinance supporters also have publicized a Facebook page with the title, Help Close the Fisk and Crawford Power Plants. So I don't know what we're supposed to think other than the clear intention here is to shut down these plants regardless of what you're hearing from others in other settings. We've also heard the charge that our plants aren't regulated or they're grandfathered from regulation. This is false. In March alone, the US EPA released nearly 1,500 pages of newly proposed air and water regulations that our plants and all other power plants in the country must meet. And by the way, these included tighter regulations on fine particulate emissions. And there are more regulations that are coming out of Washington this summer. And they also deal with fine particulate emissions. And they also deal with carbon dioxide emissions. I've also heard that the city needs to act because Washington isn't. Once again, this is false. By any measure, the Obama administration, an administration that enjoyed overwhelming support from environmental activists when they took office, has been as ambitious or more ambitious than any other administration in history in developing stricter environmental regulations. And that's not a complaint. It's a fact, and we're dealing with it. Supporters also have said this ordinance addresses pollutants that are not covered by the federal government or state of Illinois, particulate matter and carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases. Not true. Our operating permits already have limits on particulate matter, and on March 16th, as I previously stated, US EPA released proposed rules to tighten those limits significantly, including the PM 2.5 you've been talking about. US EPA also has announced that in July, it will release a second set of proposed regulations for carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas emissions, that will impact existing coal-fired plants. This is the agency that's charged by the Federal Clean Air Act with developing environmental regulations to protect the public health in every state, every city, and every neighborhood in this country. They go through a comprehensive process that anyone in this room can participate in. They draft rules, take public comment over periods of 2 to 3 months, finalize the rules, and then allow sufficient time for implementation. 3 years lead time from finalizing a rule to implementation is not unusual because they recognize the time required and the need to stagger work across plants so that we can maintain grid reliability. We've also heard, again just a while ago, that Fisk and Crawford aren't needed because the electricity they produce is sold out of state and because ComEd is building a new transmission line in the city. Let's be clear, the power produced by the men and women at these stations supports reliability and stability of the electric grid in the city of Chicago. The financial contracts for that electricity may come from anywhere in a 13-state regional power pool, but power from these plants supports the grid in this city. Electrons produced locally support the local physical grid regardless of who is purchasing them financially. And we also do have direct sales to ComEd. As for ComEd's transmission line, yes, they went to the Illinois Commerce Commission last year and were granted approval to build a new transmission line in the city. And yes, they said part of the reason they wanted the new line is because there is an uncertain long-term outlook for Fisk and Crawford. But let's look at what else ComEd said, and I'll quote you directly from their testimony. All three units at Fisk and Crawford provide important support to ComEd's transmission system serving Chicago's central business district. Even if the Fisk and Crawford stations were not retired for some years after the transmission reinforcements are completed, the addition of the new lines would protect the reliability of the central business district and make more electric sources available to serve load, bolster the system, and increase operating flexibility. This makes good operating sense. Those are ComEd's words, and what they say to me is that as long as Fisk and Crawford are operating, they're going to play a role in contributing to reliability of the Chicago grid and helping us have maximum protection against the kind of catastrophic blackouts that were experienced in the Central Business District in the late 90s. Finally, it's been our position since the ordinance was introduced last April that it is physically impossible to comply with, and here's why. It sets particulate limits that must be met at Fisk within 1 year, and I realize we heard earlier today the effective date would be, I think, July 1 of 12, but it still sets, you have to comply within 1 year of that at Fisk and within 2 years of that at Crawford. First of all, remember that the US EPA has already released stricter limits on these same particulates, including the PM 2.5 fine particulates. But note also that their implementation date is 2015, because they know that's how long it takes to build the controls that are required. And again, remember that the particulates are coming down in the same time frame further because of the reductions in nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide. The ordinance also sets carbon dioxide greenhouse gas limits that cannot be achieved at an existing coal plant with currently commercially available technology. Only a plant powered by natural gas could do that. Now, perhaps ordinance proponents are proposing that the city enable us to finance a conversion to natural gas with a power purchase contract that would be required to support the $600 to $800 million construction project that would be required. That's not what we've been hearing, but that's what it would take, and that's a different conversation than the one we're having today. But let me add, you just heard several examples from one of the witnesses here about other states converting coal to gas. That's what's happening. Those states are providing for consumer rate increases or power purchase contracts to finance those conversions. Otherwise, you can't finance that kind of construction. Nobody is talking about doing that here. And we're not a utility. We can't go to the Illinois Commerce Commission for a rate increase. We are a wholesale power provider. We get rates back in the competitive market. So if somebody wants to talk about arranging somehow for the city, the state, someone to enter into a long-term contract to convert to gas, that's a conversation. But that's not what anybody has approached us about and not what's contemplated in this ordinance, certainly. And let's also remember that the US EPA is going to be releasing proposed greenhouse gas standards for existing plants this summer. They're targeting July. And their leadership, and I was in a meeting in February in Washington, D.C. with the air administrator for US EPA, said that what they are looking at is what's technically achievable, and that's likely to be efficiency improvements. And we will look at doing that, and we should be able to do that as long as they're reasonable, achievable, and they can be. And that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Let me make one more point about carbon dioxide greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. House of Representatives 2 years ago did pass climate change legislation, and I dare say our company was as active as any company in the industry in supporting that bill. I've heard others talk about big coal, big industry trying to delay. That's not us. That's not who we are. We were in there advocating. I spent more time in Washington that year than I have in several years in several meetings with individual members lobbying in favor of the climate change legislation that was going to put additional burdens and costs on us. But it was going to bring a uniform national approach to the issue from Washington that everybody had to comply with, same time frame, same regulation. That's the way you do it. If you do a one-off climate change legislation here in the city of Chicago, all you're going to do is displace that power. You shut down these plants. The power gets picked up by plants over in Indiana that, so A, you haven't reduced carbon dioxide emissions at all, they're still there, and B, because Indiana's regs aren't nearly as strict as Illinois, you get higher emissions of mercury, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide. So no environmental benefit by the city going it alone. Every environmental issue supposedly being addressed by this ordinance is being addressed by expert agencies under the Federal Clean Air Act and by state of Illinois regulations that are as tough as any in the country and tougher than most. Again, the only real impact of this ordinance would be to put jobs and the reliability of the electric grid at risk without any meaningful environmental improvements. With that, I'm going to be happy to take your questions. I'd ask if I could please introduce my president, Pedro Pizarro from Edison Mission Group, and then if Pedro and I could respond together to questions you might have about the Illinois operations or the parent company, be happy to do that. So, Pedro.
Thank you, Doug. Good afternoon. Buenas tardes, Chairman Rugai, Chairman Balser, committee members. Really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today. I appreciate also your endurance with this long session. Want to join Doug in expressing my opposition, the opposition of our company to this ordinance on behalf of the 1,100 men and women who work for our company in Illinois. At Edison Mission Group, we really pride ourselves on environmental stewardship and technical innovation and on good corporate citizenship. And as Doug described, we led the nation in developing controls for mercury emissions from coal plants. Our nitrogen oxide reductions that he described also are ahead of the rest of the country. And as federal rules that will largely catch up with Illinois are expected to be finalized this summer, we, and I think jointly with the state of Illinois, are really showing the country how to do this. We also are one of the nation's largest developers of clean, renewable wind energy. We have 30 projects in 11 states, the largest of which is in northern Illinois. We have worked with the highly regarded Electric Power Research Institute to also begin researching the economic and technical feasibility of capturing and storing carbon emissions from existing coal plants. Our Powerton station in Downside Pekin, one of the largest coal plants in the Midwest, is one of only five plants in North America that is part of that research. We have looked to the future, and we see the potential for reducing demand for electricity at peak periods through what is known as demand-side management. And this can really play a key role in energy and in environmental policy. And you heard earlier, and we're very proud of the partnership that you heard about. It's now coming into its third summer with the City of Chicago, the Department of Environment, Cook County, and with the Citizens Utility Board to make such a program available to condo and apartment high-rise buildings in the city. Frankly, the best source of energy is the one you don't have to use. So this is who we are as a company. We're a leader in the transition to more renewable and other alternative sources of energy. But as we make that transition, the responsible use of coal is essential to ensuring that our nation, this state, and this city have a reliable and affordable supply of electricity. And it will be that way for some time. Now, a little bit of my background, before taking my position as president of Edison Mission Group just in January, I had served in several executive positions, most recently as executive vice president of our utility affiliate, Southern California Edison. You heard about SCE earlier from another panelist. Edison Mission Group and Southern California Edison are the two primary operating companies of our parent company, Edison International. And as we work across the country, one of our key issues and key focus areas is working with regulators and legislators and policymakers in helping create sensible solutions that acknowledge that electricity is complex, and there's three key goal areas. Reliability, because we have to keep the lights on collectively as a market, environmental sensitivity, and ultimately consumer cost. We believe that our diverse history and expertise as both a utility and a competitive power generator give us unique insights into that public policy and into serving customers and communities, again, with sensitivity to the environment, to rates, and to the reliability. I spend a lot of my time with federal policymakers as we seek to be that constructive voice in helping to shape reasonable regulation. Let me assure you that our business and our plants are very heavily regulated at both the state and the federal levels. Hundreds upon hundreds of pages of new regulations are sweeping over our businesses here. And as Doug said earlier, this is an important point to stress, we are not complaining about that. In fact, and I'll acknowledge, there are many of our peers who do. But unlike those peers, we are not trying to stop or delay the regulations that have been released last year or earlier this year. We are not in that just say no crowd. We want to work with regulators to come up with good, sound, constructive policy. So in many respects, these policies across the country are indeed catching up with Illinois and the regulations that the Illinois EPA has already placed on us, which really makes this proposal for the city to add another layer of regulation and one that is unworkable at that all the more troubling. So yes, I am here from California. It came up earlier. And let me make clear that our presence in your city and your state has been a dominant force in our business for the 11-plus years since we founded Midwest Generation. In 1999, we set up a major regional office in Chicago to be the hub for managing our coal fleet. The people here operate and maintain those plants. They work within corporate objectives and guidelines. We all have a boss. But the people on the ground in Chicago and across Illinois are the face, they're the voice of this company. They live in these communities, they are part of these communities, and they are the men and women running these plants and running them well and with pride. We take great pride in their safe operation of those plants, their environmental stewardship, their contribution to a reliable electric grid, and their corporate citizenship. Now, I know that many dozens of those employees are here today. I know some of them hope to introduce themselves and share their views with the community. A couple of folks I'd like to highlight, people like Sid Rodriguez, a 36-year employee at Fisk Station, and a Chicago resident who was raised and attended schools in Pilsen and Little Village neighborhoods. And people like Claudia Calderon, who manages community involvement activity for us in Pilsen and Little Village. She raises her family in the community. She's taught citizenship classes there. And she makes sure that our company is on the hook to give back to the schools, the youth, and the many fine human services agencies. Speaking of our outstanding employees, let me address the employee retention and retraining amendment, which we heard for the first time about just a little while ago at the beginning of the session. And this is a bit of, you know, the quick on-the-fly reaction, but I wanted to share it. Our company and I personally have been very transparent with our employees, as well as with the financial community, that we are running plants that have to compete in what is honestly a very tough and very competitive energy market. You've heard about PJM. It's a 13-state region. Now, being competitive means that we live and die all determined ultimately by economics and by market forces. We are not a regulated utility, as Doug said. We cannot go to the ICC and go seek rate increases or rate-based to go fund investments that might look uneconomic today, but that might have a policy angle to them. We do not get to recover our costs directly through consumer rates. If we can't make money generating electricity, we simply can't pay people to work at our plants. Now, we are working very hard to keep all our plants competitive, and we have been honest, again, with our employees that if this ordinance imposes requirements that are impossible to meet, both physically and financially, this ordinance will shut down their plants and will shut down their jobs. And, you know, as you look at this, we have worked with our employees, not only those in the city plants at Fisk and Crawford, but this really affects more than just them. This affects all of our employees across Illinois. Because, for example, if somehow magically we tried to place everyone in the other plants outside of the city, that would increase the operating costs of those plants, that would make them less competitive, that would threaten their ability to operate in markets, and frankly, that would threaten jobs across all of our plants. So this is not just about jobs in Pilsen and Little Village, this is about jobs throughout Illinois. And I think that's why the buses from Northern Illinois, the folks were eager to board those buses this morning. Now, a big part for me of giving back to our community and to our employees is telling our story about what is happening at the plants, what we're doing to make them safer, cleaner, more reliable, and we have an accountability and a responsibility to do that with all of our partners in the community, and we take that seriously. Now, hopefully you'll get the chance to hear in a few minutes from Dr. Peter Valberg of Gradient Consulting. We brought him in to study actual particulate emissions and potential health impacts from our plants. We didn't know Dr. Valberg before we commissioned this work. We commissioned it, but he worked independently, and we only knew that he came highly recommended as a respected national figure in this topic. Now, I made my own first Chicago visit as president of Edison Mission a top priority in January, and I'm not just some sort of distant California executive. I've been here many times since then and will continue to do that. It's just part of working with a wonderful employee base here. I knew about this ordinance and the efforts by some to shut down our plants. I wanted to see the neighborhoods. I wanted to walk through them, be near our plants for myself. I wanted to understand the issues here, and I wanted to know if our state of Illinois agreement is enough to protect the public. I wanted to know if the unprecedented wave of new federal regulations is also enough. I didn't want to sugarcoat it. I wanted to make sure that we are living up to our responsibilities to the city and to the Pilsen and Little Village communities to act in an environmentally responsible manner. So I've reviewed Dr. Valberg's work, as well as that of others, in evaluating our emissions. I have gone over it all in detail, looked at the controls that we have installed, the controls that we are installing, and the additional controls we're now designing. And I would not sit before you here today and offer this testimony if I had any concern about the impact of our operations in those neighborhoods. Now, before closing, let me reference a point that you heard from Doug. Nothing is being delayed or held off here in Chicago. And it was no accident that the Chicago plants were the first in our fleet to get the mercury emission reduction technology that we helped develop for the rest of the country. More nitrogen oxide reductions are right behind, and they will be in place in less than 8 months across our Illinois fleet. We are well into designing scenarios and options for meeting the federal particulate limits and state sulfur dioxide limits that come next. And frankly, we do face some very tough decisions about whether we can afford to make those investments or whether we need to retire more of our units over time. It's tough. I mean, we have a responsibility to our investors. We also have a responsibility to our employees. This ordinance is an extremely important matter to us. That's why we're all here. It's part of a national debate over whether we will continue to use coal to generate electricity. As proposed, it seems clear to us that the ordinance is intended to shut down these two plants, but more importantly, to strike a political blow against coal, which is a resource that is an American resource that provides energy independence and that today powers half of the nation's electric supply. Some of the supporters of the ordinance have made no bones about that. They want coal shut down everywhere without really thinking about the reliability or cost impacts to our economy and our society. So I suggest to you that this is a dangerous policy, and the better policy is the one being laid out and implemented today from Washington, from Springfield, and at our Fisk and Crawford plants. So I am very proud to deliver that message in true partnership with the president of Local 15 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Dean Apple, who I know is ready to speak next after your questions. And he really represents the backbone, the heart and soul of our business, and who are really the working men and women. So with that, I want to thank you again for your time. And Chairman, if you can let me know if you want to take questions now or move on
no,
to Dean.
We do. Okay. I'm asking you the same question I've asked to others before. You agreed to this, and it wasn't you directly in 2006, I don't believe, that signed the agreement. Knowing what the agreement covered in those three areas, which isn't totally included in this ordinance, but still haven't been done as yet with the NOx and the SOx, somewhat, but not totally, why did you sign on to it?
Am I on?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, the agreement gave us certainty for a lengthy period of time. I talked about $1.5 billion of investment over a decade that we don't enter into lightly. This gave us a roadmap for how to do that, how to stagger that, and how to make it economically viable for us to do. It also was the Illinois EPA was looking at various federal standards that were in progress or anticipated in the years ahead and trying to design to that. So when we talk about some of the things coming out of Washington in the future, we've tried to anticipate here, at least Illinois EPA did, what will be required in the way of future sulfur dioxide reductions, future nitrogen oxide reductions. That's why I say we're ahead of the curve in many respects. Mercury, the federal mercury rules come out in 2015. We were there in 2008. So there was a lot of educated anticipation of what was coming from Washington and the state of Illinois desiring to get ahead of that, and they did. And we tried to work in good faith to make that happen.
And I think mercury has been somewhat set aside in this whole thing. I think it's SOx, NOx, but this ordinance, the PM and the carbon dioxide. And scrubbers have been discussed. I've known about scrubbers, and I'm not a scientist, and I'm not in any of the electrical fields for years. And it sounds as though that's simple. Why can't scrubbers be installed to capture any of the pollutants.
Right.
Not PM.
Right.
I don't believe, although when you lower, and again, I understand, when you lower SOx and NOx, it lowers the PM. Not fully, but it lowers it. So you are under that agreement to lower those. Why can't you use scrubbers? Right.
What the state did in setting up this 10-year plan was prioritized. They looked at where current emissions are. They looked at where current federal standards were for air quality standards for regions like the Chicago area. Priority one was, let's get after mercury. There's no regulation of mercury. Did that.
And it was coming, though. Mercury was coming, so everybody at the state and everybody knew that they were going to be forced to, so let's get ahead of it and do it.
So that was priority one, and priority one was to do it first in the city of Chicago, which we did. Priority two was nitrogen oxide contributes to ozone. That was the major concern of Illinois EPA. Let's get after that next, because, again, the magnitude of this, you cannot do all of these projects in one fell swoop or in a matter of a few months. They have to be staggered. You have to take units offline, then bring them back. So the sequencing was mercury, nitrogen, then sulfur. The sulfur is what we're headed for next. The nitrogen oxide is being done now.
And is nitrogen going to be done by the end of this year? 2011 is what one of your reports read.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And with sulfur dioxide, as we talked about earlier, the state EPA gave us a rate to hit that was based on what they felt was needed to protect the environment and the public health, and what they anticipated the US EPA would determine over the long term was necessary. So the message from the Illinois EPA and what I hear from Washington now at the US EPA is we're not gonna be trying to be technology prescriptive. We're gonna set rates to protect the environment, protect health. You figure out how to hit those rates, and that's what we've done. And that's what the dry sorbent injection process does, and that's what we're installing.
So your choice is to use that as opposed to scrubbers?
Correct.
And what's the economic difference between
Let me jump in on this one, because
it sounds simple.
This came up, and I really didn't like the tone before that almost implied this was duct tape that we were putting on. I'm sorry. Thank you. Is that better? I apologize. So this is not duct tape, but let me share some numbers with you. When you look just at the sulfur dioxide controls, as we look across our entire Illinois fleet, right after we had signed the agreement with the Illinois EPA, or the Illinois EPA imposed the CPS, the MOU, as it's been called here earlier, the estimate for achieving the sulfur dioxide reductions using a traditional method of scrubbers, but basically that includes fabric filters, et cetera, that estimate was something, and Doug can correct me if I have the details a little off here, but something we're in the neighborhood of about $3.5 billion across our entire fleet. That was at a time when market prices across that broad PJM market were much higher than they are today. Prices have come down, and so now the revenues that we can expect to get into that market are a lot less. So in order to make the math work out, right, in order to be able to afford this and keep the jobs and keep the plants running, we needed to go back and find some more innovative technology, some better creative solutions. And so dry sorbent injection is a technology that's been around for several decades but had not been done at this scale. Our engineers piloted that technology, showed that it is successful. We have now received permits from the EPA for a couple first of the plants. That brings the total expected cost to more like $1.2 billion. This is still big money. This is still a major investment decision. It's still not clear that by the time we get to that deadline in the Illinois agreement, we'll still be having to sharpen our pencils and look at where our market prices, where are other regulations from the federal level, and does this still make sense at each of our plants? And then maybe somewhere it does, and there may be others where we end up deciding that the economic choice that we have is to shut down the plants per the agreement. Those are decisions that we will make on the timeline that we agree with the Illinois EPA, but I really wanted to give you a little bit more detail around, because I think you're asking a good question, why dry sorbent injection and why not scrubbers? Ultimately, it is an economic choice, with a factor of three attached to it that allows us to increase the opportunity for finding these plants to be economic, keeping those jobs, and keeping the plants in the system.
And we heard about that being presented as the dry sorbent injections as being more dangerous. I personally don't have any knowledge of it, so that I think that's something that have to be explored further, because that hasn't been mentioned, as far as I know, in any of this. Where's your coal come from?
It comes from the Powder River Basin of Wyoming. These plants, when they were owned by ComEd, when the Federal Clean Air Act regulations came in for sulfur dioxide in the 1970s, ComEd was burning Illinois coal at the time. They converted the infrastructure at the plants to use low sulfur Western coal for environmental compliance, and so that's what we inherited when we bought the plants.
I had heard that it didn't come from her, so I wanted to make sure.
Yes, that's
the
correct.
Nine coal plants in California have converted or are operated by natural gas.
So
they convert?
California as a state passed legislation that is taking California, removing coal from the resource tag in California. So today, operating inside California, I think it's very little coal. There are major coal deliveries, coal electricity deliveries from outside the state borders to some of the utilities. That was a choice that California made at a state level. We as a company, and by company I really mean across our broadest, in the broadest sense, both the utility and at Edison Mission Group, we have advocated that these kinds of regulations really belong at the national level, particularly if the focus is greenhouse gas reduction. Because you want to make sure that if you're going to have regulation, and if it's going to require new investments, you heard the number earlier, but probably $600 to $800 million to convert Fisk and Crawford to natural gas, if society somehow is going to absorb that cost someplace through higher prices, we want to make sure that there's actually a greenhouse gas reduction impact from it. And focusing in on Fisk and Crawford, if those two plants shut down tomorrow magically, they operate in a market. So what's going to happen next? There's still going to be demand, right? So somebody's going to have to make those electrons. The way the market works is that the plants get picked up by the market in order of increasing cost. So if Fisk and Crawford go away tomorrow, the next plants to fill the void that they'll leave behind, right, will likely be coal plants. It's been studied. And as you look at the next set of resources out there, it's more coal plants. Those are likely coal plants outside of Illinois that don't have the same kinds of mercury controls that ours have, that don't have the NOx controls that we're putting on now. So the effect on the broader region, and I really like the comments by the commissioner earlier this morning, this is about the region in addition to being about the city. It's about both. Likely result would be more emissions across the region because you're going to the next set of plants that may not have those controls. And by definition, if they're the next slightly more expensive plants, that means that they're slightly less efficient than ours. So they're burning more coal to produce the same number of electrons. So actually, greenhouse gas emissions likely go up by some small amount as you keep on going down the stack. That's what happens when one tries to control the issue, an issue that's of national scale, at too granular a level. That's why, yes, California has enacted state legislation. Our affiliated utility is complying with all that. It also has the country's leading portfolio of renewable resources. We're supportive of migrating towards a more environmentally sensitive resource stack across the country. That's, again, what you heard me talk about, the demand response pilot here, the work with EPRI on potential carbon capture and sequestration, potential for existing power plants. We need all of these arrows in the quiver in order to move the country forward. And that's also why we've invested so heavily in wind resources. We think that's part of migrating the country over time, but in a sensible way, in a way that doesn't introduce artificial disruptions into the economy by trying to pull the plug on, you know, plants earlier than may be needed, by trying to introduce costs before the technology has caught up to them.
I think that you've heard very clearly from everyone they want it all. We want, I believe, it's my personal, is the health and safety of the surrounding areas, the citizens. That would be mine. Greenhouse gases would be 1B or 1A next to that, and 1C, the economy and jobs and all of those things. So we want all of those to happen. And I can't talk about one without the other.
Well, and Chair, if I could, I agree with number one being health and safety, which is why, to me, you know, if I leave one message with you, both from us as a company and from me personally, that's why we've invested a lot, not only in controls since we purchased these plants 11 years ago, but wanted to get expert advice from Dr. Valberg. We are very confident that health and safety is just not an issue, and it's not an issue that these plants are creating. It is a big issue for a company to continue to always make sure we're being good stewards. We don't see the ordinance moving the needle in that respect. And I appreciated the discussion today about if we are worried as a society about emissions, whether it be PM 2.5 or any other one, let's look at the full pie. Let's look at all the sources. When these plants at most contribute half of 1% or less of emissions within the area, let's go after the issues that are the 20 and 30% contributors.
And would you be willing to meet with some of the city council members, some of the proponents of the environmental groups, our city department, to try and craft something? You mentioned the power purchase, that you were saying several things weren't in the ordinance that could have been. Perhaps those are things that could be under discussion to do all of the elements that we talked about, 1A, 1B, 1C. So you'd be willing to?
Yeah, well, I think that is exactly what we did when the Illinois EPA developed its 2006 regulations.
Right, and so that's why I keep asking the question of everyone, why no one was yelling back in 2006.
Again, my understanding is a lot of those groups, had a voice. And in fact, you heard the comments that Doug was reading from a number of the groups supporting the agreement then. At the same time, we're always welcome dialogue with any group. That's part of our responsibility in the community.
We heard that. Welcome it. All right, that's it. I know my colleague's just sighing with Chairman Balser first.
ComEd sold you the plant in 1999. Am I correct?
Yes.
And they had it from 1903 to 1999. How many problems have you addressed since you took over in this 11-year period? How much have you invested in cleaning up?
Right. Our major investments have been both pollution controls and improving safety in the plants. A lot of work with the piping in the plants and rewrapping the piping.
Do you have a dollar amount?
And the dollar amount, when you put all of that in over the last 10 years, is something a little over $100 million.
Okay, so you took over what was basically a mess. If you look at it with the pollutants, I'm being honest here. I mean, you had to spend $100 million
to clean this up and
meet environmental standards. Am I right? Okay.
We thought there was an important need for us right out of the box to make major investments here, both because they were needed, but also to show how serious we were about going above and beyond.
Right. Okay, that's where I was. How much would it cost, not in an estimate, for Fisk and Crawford coal-fired power plants to upgrade the plant standards in regards to the Chicago Clean Power Ordinance?
First of all, on the carbon emissions, there is no commercially available technology to do that. So that's why we say it's a shutdown ordinance. You can't meet those standards with an existing coal plant with existing technology. The particulate matter, it does go well below what the federal government has already proposed, and it would require more than $100 million of investment to comply with that. However, we will be making additional investments. I don't have a precise dollar figure.
You're making additional investments.
Absolutely. Okay, good. We will have to comply with the federal particulate standards.
Right, if these two plants were to shut down, I heard the number of 200 people.
Correct.
Is it total 200? And we're not counting carpenters and other people that may come in and have to do ancillary work in there.
Exactly.
Electricians. If the plant would close down, how much would it cost the community more in electric for the electric bills?
I really
would. All right, that's an estimate. Okay, good.
Even hazard a guess.
Is there a possibility of more electrical outages and rolling outages where you have to, if this plant were to shut down, is that a possibility?
Yeah, I was trying to address that in quoting from ComEd's testimony to the ICC, where they point out that Fisk and Crawford play a major role in stabilizing the Chicago grid, with particular emphasis on the downtown Central Business District. So absolutely, in ComEd's own words.
Can you,
point of
my
information?
Colleagues asking, point of information, could you go a little bit more in depth on that?
Let me jump in here as well. I fully agree with what Doug said. Again, just by way of background, my last job in our regulated utility included overseeing the transmission and distribution grid and doing the planning for that. You know, from everything I've seen, ComEd, along with PJM, the market operator, are being, you know, trying to do prudent work to prepare for any eventuality. And one of the eventualities that they've seen out there is the possible shutdown of these plants. So they determined that would have a serious effect, and therefore they have developed this transmission project that you heard about to add insurance to the system. As a grid operator and a grid planner, folks who have that background, they recognize that you're always planning for contingencies on the system. And so the more options you have, the higher the inherent reliability of the system, because it says you have different sources of backup. Today, Fisk and Crawford are critical to the Central Business District in Chicago because their plants are here, they're producing, they add diversity to the generation mix. What ComEd, you know, apparently determined was that if those two go away, that creates significant risk to continuing to operate the grid, the local grid reliably, and therefore the transmission system needed bolstering. However, it's also true to say that with both the transmission system and the plants in operation, you have an even more reliable, you know, grid, because you now are still keeping more options open. And that's what electric planning is all about. It is about constantly looking at a balance between what's an appropriate reliability level, you know, what kinds of power plant and transmission line outages, how many of those can you handle? How many can you handle on the hottest day of the year? How many can you handle in the off-peak? And how do you plan to make sure you always have this, you know, fine balance across multiple resources to keep the grid stable? And how do you do that while also worrying about the end-use customer costs? And so ComEd clearly made a decision that with the risk that they viewed around the future of Fisk and Crawford, it was prudent in their view, and, you know, it's what I read from the outside, prudent in their view to take a project to the Illinois Commission in order to add another piece of insurance for grid reliability. But I'm pretty sure that the engineers sitting there will feel a lot better about keeping the lights on under multiple contingencies if they have that line and the plants operating too. Does that address your question?
No, thank you, Madam Chairman. That's it.
Alderman Moreno.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your time. Thank you for traveling from California, and it's nice to see a fellow Latino as a CEO of a company. That makes me very hopeful and very proud. Prior to me becoming alderman a year ago, I was a vice president of a union printing company. We dealt with the EPA very much, very profitable, very capitalistic, myself included, in the true sense of capitalism and the Adam Smith sense. So I just wanted to give you a little background on that. I've got a couple, several questions. Can you talk to me a little bit about what you did in New Mexico recently? I think in November of last year, your plants, you had a 48% stake in five plants, I believe, in New Mexico. Is that correct?
Oh, are you referring to our regulated utility affiliate?
I'm referring to specifically the plants 1, 2, 3. I think you closed those three plants, and then you sold the other two to for $294 million. Is that correct?
Yeah. So again, you're talking about San California Edison, and we do have we are separate affiliates. So I do need to, you know, state for the record that I'm not speaking on SCE's behalf, but I can comment on that since I was there at the time. Southern California Edison is currently a part owner of that 48% stake in the Four Corners, and those the units you mentioned at the Four Corners plant. As chairman,
but you sold your 48% stake, correct?
It sold the 48% stake. That still, that transaction has not closed. That's why I say it's currently a 48% owner. As Chair Rugai mentioned earlier, California has passed legislation, and one piece of legislation specifically imposes some restrictions on continued ownership in power plants that have emissions above a certain level, which basically means that Southern California Edison would not be able to continue to make investments as an owner of that plant. So the plant was headed for either shutting down, because SCE would not be able to remain an owner of that, or in the alternative, SCE was able to negotiate the transaction where it sold its interest to Arizona Public Service. So that's the...
So plants 1, 2, and 3 have been closed, though, correct?
You know, I've lost track of what's still open, what's closed. I think...
But 3 of the plants have been closed.
That may be the case. I'm sorry.
I think they were closed because they were older plants. Would that be correct, why they were closing?
Again, I don't...
You're the CEO, correct?
I was the executive vice president for SCE. I am the president of Edison Mission Group today.
Okay, so...
I believe what you're referring to is that Arizona Public Service announced that they, as part of the overall transaction, they would be retiring some of their older plants.
How old were they?
I don't recall it.
Ballpark? 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s?
Again, don't recall.
Okay, you think they're as old as 1903?
No, they were not that as
okay.
old.
Okay, so they're closed for being older, and they're younger than a 1903 company. My question for Doug, where do you live?
Lamont.
Lamont. How often are you at the plant in Pilsen?
Oh, frequently. It varies. I was just there 2 times last week.
And but you don't live in Pilsen Little Village?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Not because the plant's there, if that's the suggestion. My wife lived in the suburbs when we met, got
okay,
married,
fair
and
enough.
Live in the suburbs.
You can say for personal reasons.
Downtown.
I was just curious because I was curious where you like to eat there. Where do you like to eat in Pilsen Little Village?
I can't quote you the names of restaurants. I've been out with people.
So you don't
from
spend a
plant.
Lot of time there. That's my point.
Spend a lot of time at
point.
The plant.
Here's where we're going with this. You said that it was false that the federal government has pushed away their responsibility. That was your statement, correct? That's a false statement. You said that they are actually tackling this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Were you here when U.S. Congressman Bobby Rush was speaking?
Yes.
Okay. He has the opposite view, and he's a congressman. He said that they have, in fact, pushed the ball down the road, and that's why we need to act. So he's incorrect?
Congress did not pass climate change legislation. I talked about how we worked hard to lobby in favor of a House bill that passed. Senate did not pass it. However, the US EPA on its own initiative is promulgating rules for greenhouse gas emissions. So it's still coming from the US EPA even though Congress has failed to act.
So Congress has failed?
On greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay.
Even though we support the climate change legislation that was in front of Congress. All the other regulations I talked about, including those that govern particulate matter, are coming out of Washington, and they aren't being stopped by Congress. There are a lot of bills and proposals and discussions and hearings about that, but nothing has happened to delay or stop that, and we haven't supported any of those efforts.
So you had accused the Chicago Tribune of making false statements. Are you suing them?
No.
Okay. Here's another statement from the Chicago Tribune. Republican lawmakers in Washington seeking to block tougher pollution limits proposed by the Obama administration, Midwest Generation now appears to be hedging on its next steps. So your view is Republicans aren't doing that, or some Democrats as well?
Our view is that we have not supported those bills. Those bills have not passed, and the regulations are continuing to come at us, and we have to comply with them.
Did you support the bill, the recent EPA bill in California? Were you guys a supporter of that? The state laws that are changing from getting rid of coal, were you guys supporting that? Was your company supporting the state laws in California?
Which there have been a lot of state laws in
that
California,
made you sell,
which one specifically?
Okay, so in November 2010, and you're still currently going through
sure?
the sale, you have 5 plants that you're selling
uh-huh.
per that law. Did you support that law?
Oh, that law, the law was probably from 2006. I don't recall what the company's position was on that.
Okay. In 2009, you had $850 million in profits. You had over $12 billion in revenues. And you had over $41 billion in assets. Congratulations. I think capitalistically, I wish I was part of that company. But environmentally, and from a public policy standpoint, I just don't see how it gels that you closed 3 plants in Arizona because they were old. Yet we've got a plant that's from 1903, and you can't seem to retrofit or fix that. With $41 billion in assets?
Well, let me strongly disagree with how you're characterizing it. First of all, but Southern California Edison did, SCE did not close those plants. SCE sold its interest in plants to a future owner. Here, we will be driven, as you said earlier, by market forces and what's economic. We've already shut some of the plants in Illinois down, like Will County 1 and 2, some of the units there. We are going to continue to look at what makes sense in terms of the totality of the regulations, market prices, et cetera. But very important part that I want to respectfully challenge is, but us, our readiness to make investments. In fact, as came up earlier, we've been making investments in the plants in Illinois since we purchased those plants 11 years ago. We continue to make investments today. We're in the middle of NOx controls. We're in the middle of designing SO2 controls that will also help with particulates. So, I stand by our company's record in working its way through complying with regulations.
Right, and as CEO, your responsibility is to the shareholders, and I get that, and that's your responsibility, bottom line. And your words economic choice means basically you make the choices based on revenues, profits, et cetera. That's what a CEO does. And again, I'm glad that it's a Latino that's doing that. However, your product pollutes. So then, why then, if your product pollutes, we have to look at it from a different standpoint than just the bottom line when you're making economic choices. Would you agree?
I'm going to disagree with the implication of the statement. Again, it will be important to hear from Dr. Valberg later on, but when I take a look at a resource where we've installed significant controls over the past decade, we're complying with all applicable regulations, where if you focus on some of the topic in the earlier in the day today around some of the specific emissions, it's contributing less than a half of 1%, and it pales in comparison to other sources that have been discussed already. We're being a good corporate citizen, and we're proud of it.
Okay. Last question, because I know my colleagues have a lot, and I don't want to take up all the time. When you have, you say you're complying with a lot of the legislation that's out, okay? What specifically in the state of California, let's take because of the decisions there, what specific legislation does your company support as a company prior to its enactment?
I can't give you the litany of all the pieces we supported. There have been many. California's had a lot of active legislation. I will give you the most recent and prominent one that Southern California Edison and Edison International, our parent company, supported. And that is the new 33% renewable standard in California. Governor Jerry Brown just signed that, a week or two ago, and our company, our regulated utility, was one of the companies supporting that.
Great. Thank you for coming to Chicago. Hope you enjoy
your
time.
My pleasure. I'm here a lot, and I look forward to being back.
What's your favorite restaurant?
What was the place that we ate?
No, you don't have to answer that.
There's a great little Italian place in one of the wards. Bacchanalia, that was great.
Bacchanalia. Yeah. Chai aficionado. Alderman Riley.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I appreciate your being here and your testimony, and I think all of my colleagues are asking excellent questions today. I have a couple of questions I wanted to follow up on. During your testimony earlier, you mentioned that Edison Mission has 30 wind projects across 11 states, the largest being in Illinois. What is Midwest Generation's total investment commitment to wind power here in Illinois?
I think the project we built was on the order of $600 million.
Sorry, $600 million for wind power in Illinois?
I believe it.
As I mentioned earlier, your company, Midwest Generation, has been working very closely with the Citizens Utility Board, the largest consumer protection organization in the state of Illinois, as well as the Northern Illinois Energy Project and the city's own Department of Environment on a demand response program in some of the city's largest and most dense buildings, residential and commercial. Could you explain your role in that project? I know a lot about it because I've dedicated hundreds of hours working on it with that coalition because one of the greatest causes of emissions and one of the great contributing factors to our air quality problems is actually our large buildings. Could you provide a little bit more detail to my colleagues on your involvement in that very important environmental program?
Sure, and just as a quick setup for it. What we did 3 or 4 years ago was look at, as a business for the long term, where's this country and society headed? It's toward less dependence on fossil fuels. Our company obviously heavily engaged in fossil fuels. We have to prepare for the future. We have to be prepared for the transition. What are all the options? Wind, obviously, is one. But we also, the demand-side management, we felt was something that might be of interest to us in the long term. As Pedro said, the best megawatt in energy conservation is the one you didn't produce. So we learned of the Citizens Utility Board having a major interest in trying to get a pilot project started in the city with large high-rise apartment and condo buildings to control air conditioning usage on the hottest days of summer, conserve energy on peak demand days. And so it really came up, I think, happenstance over a dinner one evening when we learned of that from CUB. And we said, let's try to be a catalyst for that. We've got some expertise in the energy industry. They have an interest. And we found out the city was part of an organization, the Northern Illinois Energy Project, I think, looking to get it started. So we were some of the seed money. We also had the understandings of the workings of this PJM market, because what you're doing, instead of selling power into the market, you're getting paid to reduce demand in that market. And we have experts in our marketing and trading organization know how to do that. We knew of a company in Indianapolis that was well-regarded nationally, had worked with our affiliate on the equipment side of installation and monitoring the equipment. So we were able to bring them into the table. So I think an overall Alderman facilitation role, some seed money, and for us, constant learning about, is this potentially a line of business for us to branch into? We don't look at ourselves as just a generator. We're an electricity provider, and generation is part of that, and conservation can be part of it too.
And you also talked quite a bit about your company's role in developing mercury controls that are being used across the industry. Based on that experience, could you please give us a list of the technologies available today that will allow these plants to reduce their CO2 emissions?
As I said, there is no commercially available technology that's in the marketplace today for an existing coal plant. We've heard discussed new plants called coal gasification plants that are really still in a research and development stage. There's a project called FutureGen that's been on and off again and is still not come to fruition yet in Southern Illinois, which is part of that R&D and exploration. But there's nothing today that you can go to a vendor, a supplier, and say, I want bids on carbon dioxide controls for my existing coal plant.
Speaking about gasification plants, say that project that you just mentioned were to eventually gain legislative approval and move forward, what would the timeline be for getting that type of a plant built up and running and actually serving the PJM market?
Not recalling off the top, but I think you're a good five.
Could it be done by July 1st, 2012?
No. You're a good 5 years or so out.
And Alderman, if I could amplifying that a little bit, because I want to make sure that for folks who are not as close to the energy industry as some of you are, so we don't confuse terms. Coal gasification literally means making gas out of coal. That is a process, and it's been done, but it's not a readily commercially available, go to the contractor and have the standard bid kind of project. That is different from, because we've also heard the term gas used in the context of natural gas plants. Natural gas plants that use readily available natural gas are a much more standard technology. Even there, though, quite frankly, Doug was talking earlier about if there were a magical contract for a power purchase agreement to repower these plants and turn them into natural gas plants, it still takes probably at least a couple of years of actual construction and time before that. For permits, for interconnection queue processes, a number of issues that would probably still mean at least a 3 or 4 year timeline for a conversion to an even more standard technology.
So, as you mentioned in your testimony earlier, you can't go and directly seek ratepayer subsidies.
Correct.
That's just the way of life.
Not our business.
As a result, if the solutions here are cost prohibitive, there is a potential that these plants could be closed. You're suggesting that other coal plants, based on the way PJM works, other coal plants that can provide energy at a lower cost, likely because they don't have these more expensive controls in place, could potentially be generating more electricity to fill that gap. You said regionally this may have a negligible impact on improvements to the environment. Is that correct?
That's fair.
So would it be a stretch then to suggest by effectively closing down these two plants, we would be eliminating Illinois jobs and investment, I guess, to the cost of Illinois families and to the benefit of those folks in other states that provide this dirtier fuel?
Yes.
As I said earlier, and as I mentioned behind chambers to my colleague, Alderman Moore, I am eager to sit with him and the other co-sponsors of this ordinance and try and find a reasonable way to work through some of these details and these issues. I think that all of the environmental groups that have put a whole lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this ordinance should be commended for their mission. We are working to address those other components of this pie chart here in the city of Chicago related to construction, frankly, vehicle emissions. I've actually went down to Springfield and testified in support of the new state legislation, the new statute regulating bus idling. In the past year and a half, we've added 2 miles of brand new bike lanes downtown, and there is a very aggressive electric vehicle pilot program being deployed throughout Chicago over the next 2 years. We're trying to address all of these issues because the people of Chicago deserve clean air. Our families, our children, everyone does. That said, I think this is going to need a little bit more work. I think that there are some serious concerns that have been raised with the current draft. Again, I commend the sponsor and co-sponsors of this ordinance for what they're seeking to achieve here. But we need to make sure that there are realistic solutions here that don't inadvertently kill local jobs to reward dirtier plants in other states by sending the business to those folks. I appreciate you being here today, and thank you very much.
Alderman Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Initially, I'd just like to, you know, clarify one issue. You spent a lot of time in your opening remarks, alleging that this ordinance was simply a subterfuge for an intent to shut down the two power plants in Chicago. Well, I'm the chief sponsor of the ordinance, and I think I can speak for my 25 co-sponsors in saying that that's not our intent at all. Especially not our intent after I talked with members of the trades, and they indicated how important those jobs were to them. And I also came to that conclusion after talking to the experts and determining that it was in their belief that you could make the transition to a cleaner energy source and to clean up your emissions through what I believe to be reasonable regulations. So we can differ about what the ultimate effect was, but I just want to make very clear what my intent and the intent of my co-sponsors is, which is to work on cleaning these plants up to protect the health of our citizens and the welfare of our planet. So I just want to get that out of the way. Want to note that, you know, I acknowledge that you folks have undertaken steps to modify the plants already, to comply with various regulations to, if not now, certainly in the future, to clean up the emissions of certain products such as sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide. But I want to make one note that you've done so because of the hand of government, of regulations. Just like I drive slower because of speed limits. So it's not like I'm disparaging it. It's just a fact of life. I drive slower because of speed limits. I no longer hold a phone to my ear because of a prohibition against holding cell phones while driving. Those are requirements that are put into place to safeguard the safety of the public. And so the fact that you have engaged in investments and have attempted to clean up your plants thus far, that is because of regulations, not out of the goodness of your heart. Again, not disparaging, it's just a fact. And that's all these regulations attempt to do, is to attempt, in the spirit of the protecting the people that we represent in the city council and protecting our environment, to put into place additional regulations that, for whatever reason, the federal government and the state government have not seen fit or have been unable to implement. So with that, I want to ask you a question. You indicated before your concerns about feasibility, whether this was feasible at all. For example, the regulations on PM 2.5. Am I going to understand your testimony that it is not feasible at all, or it's not feasible financially or within a time frame provided by the ordinance? Yeah.
Two points on the PM 2.5. One is that it is right now the target of regulations being developed by the US EPA. There was a proposal released March 16th that has PM regulations in it that affect PM 2.5. There is going to be a proposal coming out this summer. We expect it in a June-July timeframe, that are going to set what's called national air ambient air quality standards for PM 2.5. So one point we have is that this is being addressed. PM 2.5 is being addressed at the federal level by US EPA. To this ordinance, when we say it's impossible to comply with in that regard, it's the time frame. Because to get to the level that's in this ordinance, which is lower than what the feds have proposed to date, would take about a three-year project to design, build, construct, and this is only giving us a year or two.
Okay, I ordinarily don't like negotiating in public hearings, but if we change the date to 2015, will you sign on?
Well, because the earlier point I was making, let's look at it from the health and science reasons to do it, which is what the US EPA does, and Dr. Valberg is certainly here to talk about that. We're saying uniform national standards that apply equally to everybody at the same time are the right way to regulate industry. So we disagree that the feds are ignoring this. They're addressing it, and it is this US EPA under this administration that's been strongly supported by the environmental community. So I think we've got a course going in Washington. We want to work constructively within that to bring it to fruition. Level playing field, same rules for everybody, same time, protect the public health.
Well, and I certainly agree with you that the Obama administration in many respects has had a very commendable record on the environment, and obviously you're also aware of the current political climate in Washington and in a recent election that occurred that may impede their ability to achieve those goals. But what I'm concerned about here today is what we can do as the local elected officials closest to the people to safeguard the health of our citizens. And maybe the feds will act, maybe not, but we've been waiting an awfully long time, as one of our earlier witnesses testified, and I think it's time for us to act. You had spoken about addressed the issue of reliability and whether the two plants are necessary for the reliability of the power grid. With respect to that reliability, are you suggesting they are necessary for the reliability of power distribution during ordinary days like such as today, where temperature is in the 40s? Or are you addressing the issue of those extremely hot days that occasionally the city has in the summertime, thanks in part to our warming climate, where you have to address that issue of reliability?
So I'll take that. Again, the way that utility planners and ultimately the PJM market planners look at it is a couple dimensions. The first is making sure there's enough capacity online to cover peak needs. And so that typically would be in that hot summer day, or to the extent that there's a lot of electric cooling on, you know, cold winter day. And so that's probably the lens that's the most acute lens for planners, making sure that at that worst possible case, how much insurance you need. And, oh, by the way, how much insurance do you need if you assume that you have one or two major components out of service? And so that's the planning, and it really tends to focus on the peak. In terms of the average days, that's more where the there's a market that runs. It's looking at what are the most economic resources, and those get, you know, get bid into the market and selected in terms of economic merit order. So I don't know if that helps address your question.
So in other words, if, and again, I'm not suggesting this, so don't get me wrong, but we're talking about their importance. If both the plants were shut down tomorrow, it's not going to affect the reliability of electric service to the residents of the city of Chicago, except perhaps on the peak demand days and the hot days of summer.
Well, not quite. Let me just, and maybe I wasn't as clear. Peak conditions are one of the events that go into planning for reliability, but there are others. And again, this whole issue of contingency. So you have a grid in that's serving the Chicago area. There's transmission lines coming into that. The planners are going into the analysis of, well, what if a transmission line goes out? What if two lines go out? What if, you know, what are the major power plants to support the area? What if those go out? And then the final, what they're trying to make is overly complicated. Final point I'll make is, at the end of the day, it's not just only about total megawatts available either to import the transmission lines or to generate locally. It's actually about the physics of the grid. Where plants are matters, and so having resources that can provide local support is something, also something of value to transmission or to grid planners. So, long way of saying, and it's a complex topic that I'm trying to boil down to a soundbite, but long way of saying, it's not just about that hot summer day. It's also about if a, you know, an airplane runs into a transmission tower and something terrible happens, and that's what planners worry about.
You were here earlier where Alderman Rugai, Chairman Rugai, read from ComEd's application to the ICC for permission to invest in a new transmission grid or upgrade a transmission grid. And it appeared that, based on what she read, that the ComEd had, in applying for the upgrade, the reason they were contemplating it is to ensure if Midwest Gen's plants were shut down, that there would be continued reliability. So, in other words, it seems that once they complete that, that the concern about reliability, at least with respect to the power grid in the Chicago region, will be no longer an issue.
Yes, it's clear that's the case that they are trying to cover, or that they're seeking to cover with that. My point is that in addition to that, if they end up with both, if they build the line and the plants are still here, there is a benefit to local reliability that accrues from that. Because now, should they hit at some point that, call it N minus one, you know, one major line out or one major power plant out contingency, now you have that much more reserve margin, that much more bandwidth left in the system by having both the line and the plant. So while, yes, it appears that their effort was focused on covering the basic system needs in case that the two plants are shut down, I am also certain that they would value having the plants remain in place because it's just one more element in the insurance policy to keep the lights on.
You had also testified earlier. You gave an argument that it's food for thought that if your plants were no longer generating electricity and your customers had to buy from other sources, that they may end up buying from other power plants that are fire power plants in other states that are operating in a dirtier fashion. Isn't it also true, though, that here in this region, about 60% of our electricity needs is generated by nuclear energy? And is it also true, as you yourself have not acknowledged, your commendable efforts to build a new wind-powered generators that could also provide those power needs? In other words, it does not necessarily have to mean that they're going to buy from other plants. They may buy from cleaner sources of energy.
While the resource mix that you just described is true as I understand it, And I would focus you on the easiest way to think about it. Take a snapshot of the world today. In the world today, when you do all the analysis, you know, all the economics of all the plants out there with all the regulations that each of them have in that 13-state region called PJM, Fisk and Crawford are running, you know, a good portion of the time. Brenda Brock can probably speak to, you know, specific numbers of how often they're running. But they're running a lot. So that says that given everything, given the nuclear that's there, given the wind resources that have been added, which, by the way, just go into the system in a must-take fashion, given all of that, there's still a need, there's still economic value to the overall system, and there's a reliability need for Fisk and Crawford being there. If you now, tomorrow, take Fisk and Crawford out, something else will have to come in. The nuclear's already running. The wind's already been being taken on a must-take basis into the system. So the next available choice is likely another coal plant.
Again, I'm only asking these questions not because I contemplate that would be the impact of this ordinance, but only to respond to the Chicken Little scenario that is taking place here with respect to what happens if the ordinance is passed. Let me ask you one other question. I certainly am concerned about people's jobs, regardless of where they live. But I am curious as to how many employees. How many employees do you have at the Fisk plant, and how many do you have at the Crawford plant?
Brenda, this is Brenda Brock, our station director for both plants.
Yeah, at Fisk Station, we have about 65 employees, and Crawford is about 120.
So 65 at Fisk and 120 at Crawford. Okay. So that's 185 altogether.
Approximately.
Okay. And don't worry, that exhausts my knowledge of math, so I'm about as far as it goes there.
Are they all right here today? Is anybody at the plant?
Anyone mining the store, right, Ginger?
That's right.
Of the 65 at Fisk, how many are City of Chicago residents?
I would have to say a little over a dozen.
So a little over a dozen is what, 13? A baker's dozen?
Sure.
Okay. And at Crawford, how many are City of Chicago employees?
City of Chicago?
Of the 120 workers, how many are City of Chicago residents?
I don't know how many approximately at Crawford.
Okay. Do you think it's roughly same proportion as Fisk, or you don't know?
I would say it's approximately the same.
Okay. Well, if you don't mind, if you could provide through the chair, the exact figures, and also maybe some information about how many of those residents live within 3 miles of each of those plants. We got one guy right there. Two guys. All right. Okay. Very good.
Four, five.
All right, man. Well, again, I ask these questions just. Respond to some of the threats of the closing to see just how many would be affected, but also, once again, to reemphasize that's not the intent of the ordinance, and I would be more than happy to join you in a discussion offline, as they say, to figure out a way that we can achieve the goals of a cleaner environment, a healthier environment, and also to make sure you can continue to stay in business. Thank you very much.
Any further questions? We have one more witness. I'm sorry, Alderman Solis. Oh, sorry. Alderman Dahl, and then Alderman Solis, and then Alderman Wagstaff.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Actually, my colleague, Alderman Moore, was going where I was going on the employees. Can you tell me how many jobs were in place when you took over?
Specifically, we can get you that information easily enough.
Well, just give me I'll take the specific number when you get it, but, I mean, you were there, right?
There were more jobs. There have been reductions over the years at the stations, but not, and I really wouldn't
and
want
do
to
those
try to put
reductions,
a percentage
occur because you mentioned doing $100 million worth of investment. Are those reductions because you've made upgrades to the plant, you've made it more efficient so that these jobs weren't necessary anymore?
The reductions in force we had at the plant were very early in our ownership when we put in a number of new work practices and standards. We changed operating procedures a lot in the plants and shifted to the, some of the practices that Edison Mission Group had around the country. We found some efficiencies and synergies, but that was, so you're talking about 8-10 years ago. We have not had reductions in force since then in the plants. We have had reductions in management that have been much more, a higher percentage of employees in management than in the front lines in the plants, because we want to minimize, the impacts on the front lines where people are providing the electricity.
Okay. If you could get the specific
sure.
numbers through the chair, I would appreciate it. One other thing. You're the medical expert, right? Are you you're going to testify on the science of all of this?
Yes, I'm Peter Valberg. I'll be testifying about the public health effects.
Okay, because I really would like to, I know in the paper there was a quote from someone from Midwest Generation about the fact that inhaling soot for a year was equivalent to inhaling or people mowing their lawn twice a year. And I find that just unbelievable. It's a stupid statement. So I would really like to hear what your findings are.
Alderman Dell, can we hold him? Let's finish with the questions from our colleagues, and then absolutely is a very good question. Alderman Solis, and then Alderman Wagsbeck.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Let me reiterate the point that was made by Alderman Moore, which I firmly stand behind. And it is my position on this issue is in no way should be interpreted that I want to close this plant. I want it to have clean air, and I want the jobs. I think that in the statement that I made earlier in terms of the industrial corridor and what it was before 2000 and after 2000, after the introduction of the TIF, there were jobs created in the cleanup of that area. There were jobs created when we improved the infrastructure of that area. There were businesses that came into that corridor and now pay good tax revenue to the city of Chicago. And there's over 3,000 jobs that have been created since that time. My intention is that I want what you have. If you don't live in this community, I'm sure that you live in a community that is very healthy as far as the air that you breathe, where you live and where you socialize, where you recreate. And I think that's what my community in the 25th Ward and specifically in Pilsen want. They want an industrial corridor that provides good jobs for the people that live there, and they want businesses that are going to provide a healthy environment for themselves and for their families. Now, I'm going to ask you a couple of tough questions, and then I'm going to go to the question that I think will be a win-win situation for us all. And the first one is, are the facilities Crawford and Fisk still violating capacity limits?
Not sure. You said opacity? Opacity?
Capacity limits.
Capacity limits?
Mentioned earlier. In terms of your own. Yes.
Opacity.
Right. We have never been cited by the Illinois EPA enforces opacity regulations. We have never been cited for a violation of opacity by the Illinois EPA. As was referenced, there is a lawsuit that was brought with respect to how current state regulations of opacity are interpreted. We feel strongly that our opacity performance is comparable, as good or better than other coal plants, and that the enforcement practice of the Illinois EPA has been adequate and fair and consistent.
That hasn't been resolved yet.
That has not been resolved. It is a pending case.
All right. Are scrubbers more effective at reducing SO2 than sorbent injection?
We believe that with the, based on our testing.
Not what you believe, what's understood technically and scientifically.
Can you achieve minimally more reduction with a scrubber?
Are scrubbers more effective? Yeah.
You could achieve slight additional reduction that we don't believe, and I don't think the EPA believes, under our agreement with Illinois EPA, has a material difference on health impact. That we were given a rate to hit for sulfur dioxide emissions that's based on EPA's assessment of what protects the public health and the environment.
But if you use scrubbers, they do a better job.
It would be slightly lower than we will achieve under the Illinois agreement.
And you're not doing it because of economic reasons?
We're achieving the rate based on protecting the health and environment.
But my question is, if you'd use scrubbers, would they do a more effective job than the injection method?
I don't believe they would do it. They would not do a more effective job in meeting the health standard that's set by the EPA, because we're going to meet that standard.
All right. Let me go into the question that I think is important. In your social Southern California Edison conversion, you went from coal to natural gas. What did you go? What was the conversion?
Let me address it. I think the situation is a little more complex than just saying Southern California Edison went from coal to natural gas. The state of California imposed legislations, and the California Public Utilities Commission imposed regulations that over time had all the jurisdictional utilities migrate, and they're still doing that, away from coal resources and into other resources. So.
One of those resources, natural gas?
Yeah, so today, if you take a look, again, speaking from, now as a public bystander, right, the affiliates, since I'm separate from them, now being over at the Edison Mission Group site, but in rough numbers, the Southern California Edison resource mix is something like, it's about 20% renewables, about 20% from nuclear, I want to say about 40% natural gas.
I'm talking about your companies.
Southern California Edison. It's a separate company, so I just wanted, we have affiliate. Well, it's a separate affiliate.
Whatever companies that you transitioned from coal to natural gas.
Yeah, so again, today, the Southern California Edison, the regulated utility, has very little coal left in its resource stack.
Are they being profitable?
They're a regulated utility, so their profits are regulated just like any other regulated utility would be.
Are you losing money?
Are they making money?
No, yeah, are your company?
They make earnings under regulation. Most of the resources that they provide to customers are not actually owned by the utility. In California, through deregulation, the utilities were both required to divest a minimum amount and then encouraged to divest most of their fossil fuel resources. So about two-thirds of the electrons that Southern California Edison provides to customers are actually purchased from the market. And they don't make any profit on those electrons because those are purchased resources.
So why are you involved if they don't make any profit?
Sorry,
why are you involved if you don't make any profit? I'm sorry.
No, Southern California Edison makes its profit through regulated investments in grid assets and in the resources that it owns. For the resources that it purchases through contracts, that's just a straight cost passed through to customers as part of their obligation as a deliverer of electricity under the California regulatory framework. Happy to take that offline.
So you have companies in Southern California Edison that are natural gas plants?
Southern California Edison owns a few natural gas fire plants, one large one and some small peakers, but they contract with third parties for a significantly larger proportion of natural gas-fired resources. So, yes, so about 40% of the total electrons that Southern California Edison provides to its customers, whether made in SCE facilities or purchased from others, about 40% of those, if I recall correctly, are produced with natural gas.
And again, are they making money? Are they being profitable? Maybe making money is not a...
SEE makes regulated returns. I think, Alderman, the question that you're hinting at, though, is why wouldn't that work here?
That's right.
And so let's just cut to that.
Our nose gets out of joint if something good is happening elsewhere and not here, right, when we see that we have needs.
Right. And so where we are here today, I mean, this is a question that, believe me, you know, our planners inside Edison Mission Group look at all the time. We always want to know what are the alternatives out there, right? Because we are looking for ways to grow our business. And natural gas is a fuel that's still fossil-fired, but it has lower carbon dioxide emissions, lower greenhouse gas emissions. Where market prices are today, and let me back up and stop me if this is too complex, but again, we are a competitive company. We're not a regulated utility. So we can't go to the ICC and say, hey, we have a great idea. This project might pay for itself over the next 20 years. Let's lock that in, and let's have recovery through consumer rates all, you know, written in right now. We have to go off and find our financing, get our financing from banks and investors in an open market. And you, Alderman, talked about, you know, capitalist forces. Well, that's what we do. When we take a look at where market prices are today and where the forecasts are of where market prices will go in the future, both for energy and for capacity in this market, not in California, but in PJM, the market we operate in, and specifically in this region of PJM, we cannot make the numbers work. We cannot, it is not economically feasible today for us to make that $600 to $800 million investment to convert Fisk and Crawford because we have no, our forecasts show that we will not be able to recover that investment or make a profit on it. And so it's just not, we can't afford that. So, now, if the state or the city had, as a matter of policy, an interest in doing that because you wanted to have the capacity here in the city operating with natural gas and you wanted to, you know, create a contract, even if that contract were more expensive than buying the power from the market, you know, you might say, well, we want to make the extra investment in out of the city or out of the state so that we don't have to rely on coal resources elsewhere in PJM. We don't have to rely on the market. We want the natural gas-fired resource here and when produced from that, even if it costs us more, and we're therefore going to give Edison Mission Group a contract to go convert those plants. Again, as Doug said, that's a conversation that, you know, we can engage.
That's where I was going, because if Doug had said earlier, if the conversation is about converting and working together, to convert and figure out ways to absorb the cost of $600 to $800 million, then you guys would be open to that. Now, are you in agreement with Doug on that position?
Yeah, we're always open for that kind of discussion, and I think that's a fair discussion to have. I will say, you know, and this is where the time that, frankly, I personally have spent on the policy side in California, here, or other states, again, this all goes down to the balance that regulators and policymakers are trying to strike across doing the right thing for the environment, which we all want to do that. We will do that, you know, and so the environment, environmental sensitivity, reliability, making sure you have enough supply, and cost. Okay. Yeah. So you mentioned California. California has made some choices around where it wants to take, as a state, its, you know, portfolio decisions. Those are expensive choices. The cost of power in California to a consumer is a lot higher than the cost of power to a consumer in Illinois. It's a choice the state has made. I think you've seen that also in other countries. Spain, for example, made significant investments in solar photovoltaic power. They were paying something like 45 cents, 1.60 cents a kilowatt hour for that power compared to, you know, average cost of power that was maybe a tenth of that for other resources. It's a policy choice. At some point, then there's a question about how much can the society afford, how much do you want to afford? And so, be honest with you, we'd be open to that kind of discussion, but one of the key questions that I would have and my board would have would be, is that really sustainable, or is this a potential for the Spain kind of experience where, you know, you have good intentions going into it, but then when consumers realize the cost impact is being borne by a single city or a single state, and how, you know, if it tilts costs here out of whack with respect to the market around you, you might hear from the voters as well. So I'll be honest with you, Alderman, we'd welcome the discussion, but one of the questions we would have for you would be, would your voters support that at the end of the day and over the 10 or 20-year period of a long-term contract. Mm-hmm.
One more question related to this. Is the conversion from coal to natural gas, is the jobs comparable if you transfer over to that? Or is it more, or is it less, or is it comparable?
I don't have precise details, but I can tell you in general, with the way that natural gas fire plants are configured, you have fewer jobs attached to those. Because just one example, a lot of the good folks who are sitting here from our plants, number of them might be involved, for example, in coal operations, coal handling, moving coal out of trains, et cetera, at the plant. That is simplified when the fuel is coming in through a pipe and natural gas is being delivered in. So that's one example. There are differences in the technology and the and their implications in staffing, but I don't have a precise number of.
And you wouldn't know if that's what actually happened in Southern California, Edison, or not, whether there was a loss of jobs.
I can tell you that, again, I don't recall the precise number, but, again, depending on the technology, and not just at SCE, but around the country, if you look at a 1,000-megawatt gas-fired combined cycle plant, the staffing for that, I'm going to take a little bit of a wild guess here, but might be on the order of 50 people.
Yeah.
As compared to the staffing numbers you heard from Brenda. It's just a different technology. It requires different handling. By the way, though, looking at the overall apples-to-apples comparison, don't forget that today coal in this country and power from a coal-fired plant is, if you have the investment base already there, that's a different economic picture. You wouldn't have to be looking at making the $600 to $800 million investment to retool the plant for natural gas. Electricity is all about trade-offs.
One last question, not related to this topic. Are there any other plants in the country that you're involved with that are also in large, dense urban settings, like the two plants here in Chicago, in Pilsen and Little Village?
For Edison and Doug helping out here, thinking about our portfolio, our Illinois plants are Joliet, Pekin,
Waukegan.
In Southern California, Edison Mission Group has some plants out, co-owner of plants
out
in the
Bakersfield
area.
But not in any big cities like Chicago.
Now, for Southern California Edison, since you asked about them earlier, they do have the newer natural gas fire plants are in the eastern edge of the metropolitan area where a lot of the growth has been over the last several years. So those are located
in
load centers.
But they're not coal plants.
No, those are natural gas fire plants.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Alderman Wagasbeck, and then we will go on to the health expert that's here with us, and then we'll get everybody else in. We're going to have to limit till 4:30.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think...
I'd
almost rather jump to the health portion, and questions were about how much they were investing in R&D compared to their competitors.
Okay.
And their overall... investments in clean power, but I think I can look that up myself. I was already looking at their SEC report and looking at some of that information, but why don't we just jump to the health portion of it and hear what the lawnmower report has to say.
Okay. Hear what the what?
The lawnmower report.
Oh, the lawnmower.
TEPCO 2, maybe?
Do you need to take a break? The 2 minutes to change our paper for the... I'm sorry.
You can all wait for me, all right? I'll stand here and watch while I go to the bathroom.